"Thank you," he said. "Where will you go?" she asked him. He thought again of his father. "Where do jongleurs tell their tales?" he asked. "On the pilgrim road to Santiago de Compostela." "Do you think the jongleurs might remember Jack Cherbourg?"
"They might."
"Tell them he looked like you. Where's Compostela?"
"In Spain."
"Then I'm going to Spain."
"It's a long way, Jack. I've got time."
She put her arms around him and hugged him tight. He wondered how many times she had done that in the last 18 years, comforting him over a grazed knee, a lost toy, a boyish disappointment, and now a grief that was all too grown up. He thought of the things she had done, from raising him in the forest to getting him out of the punishment cell. She had always been willing to fight like a cat for her son. It hurt to leave her. She let him go, and he swung up onto the horse. He looked back at Kingsbridge. It had been a sleepy village with an old tumble-down cathedral when he first came here. He had set fire to that old cathedral, although not a soul knew it but him. Now Kingsbridge was a busy, self-important little town. Well, there were other towns. It was a wrench to go, but he was on the edge of the unknown, about to embark on an adventure, and that eased the pain of leaving everything he loved. Mother said, "Come back one day, please, Jack."
"I'll come back.
Promise?" "I promise. If you run out of money before you find work, sell the horse, not the tools," she said.
"I love you, Mother," he said.
Her eyes overflowed.
"Take care of yourself, my son."
He kicked the horse, and it walked away. He turned and waved. She waved back. Then he kicked it into a trot, and after that he did not look back. Richard came home just in time for the wedding. King Stephen had generously given him 2 days' leave, he explained. The king's army was at Oxford, laying siege to the castle, where they had Maud trapped, so there was nothing much for the knights to do. "I couldn't miss my sister's wedding day," Richard said, and Aliena sourly thought, "You just want to make dead sure the deed is done so that you get what Alfred has promised you." Still, she was glad he was there to walk her to the church and give her away. Otherwise, she would have had nobody. She put on a new linen undershirt and a white dress in the latest style. There was not much she could do with her mutilated hair, but she twisted the longest parts into plaits and bound them in fashionable white silk sheaths. A neighbor loaned her a looking-glass. She was pale, and her eyes showed that she had spent a sleepless night. Well, there was nothing she could do about that. Richard watched her. He wore a faintly sheepish look, as if he felt guilty, and he fidgeted restlessly. Perhaps he was afraid she would call the whole thing off at the last minute. There were moments when she was sorely tempted to do just that. She imagined herself and Jack walking away from Kingsbridge hand in hand to start a new life somewhere else, a simple life of straightforward, honest work, free from the chains of old vows and dead parents. But it was a foolish dream. She could never be happy if she abandoned her brother. When she reached that conclusion, she imagined going down to the river and throwing herself in, and she saw her limp body in a waterlogged wedding dress drifting downstream, face up, with her hair floating around her head. And then she realized that marriage to Alfred was better than that, and she came back to where she started, regarding the marriage as the best available solution to most of her troubles. How Jack would pour scorn on that kind of thinking. The church bell tolled. Aliena stood up. She had never visualized her wedding day this way. When she had thought about it as a girl, she had imagined herself on her father's arm, walking from the castle keep across the drawbridge to the chapel in the lower courtyard, with papa's knights and men-at-arms, servants and tenants packed into the castle precincts to cheer and wish her well. The young man waiting in the chapel had always been rather indistinct in this daydream, but she knew that he adored her and made her laugh, and she thought he was wonderful. Well, nothing in her life had turned out the way she expected. Richard held the door of the little one-room house, and she went out into the street. To her surprise, some of the neighbors were waiting outside their doors to see her go by. Several people called out, "God bless you," and "Good luck," as she emerged.
She felt terribly grateful to them. She was showered with corn as she walked up the street. Corn was for fertility. She would have babies, and they would love her. The parish church was on the far side of town in the wealthy quarter, where she would be living from tonight. They walked past the monastery. The monks would be holding their service in the crypt right now, but Prior Philip had promised to put in an appearance at the wedding feast and bless the happy couple. Aliena hoped he would make it. He had been an important force in her life ever since the day, 6 years ago, when he had bought her wool at Winchester. They arrived at the new church, built by Alfred with help from Tom. There was a crowd outside. The wedding would take place in the porch, in English. Then there would be a Latin mass afterward inside the church. Everyone who worked for Alfred was there, and so were most of the people who had done weaving for Aliena in the old days. They all cheered when Aliena arrived. Alfred was waiting with his sister Martha and one of his masons, Dan. Alfred was wearing a new scarlet tunic and clean boots. He had long, gleaming dark hair like Ellen's. Aliena realized that Ellen was not here. She was disappointed. She was about to ask Martha where her stepmother was when the priest came out and the service began. Aliena reflected that her life had been set on a new course 6 years ago, when she had made a vow to her father. And now a fresh era was beginning with another vow to a man. She rarely did anything for herself. She had made a shocking exception this morning with Jack. When she recalled what she had done, she could hardly believe it. It seemed like a dream or one of Jack's fanciful tales, something that had no connection with real life. She would never tell a soul. It would be a lovely secret she would hug to herself and remember once in a while, like a miser counting a hidden hoard in the dead of night. They were coming to the vows. On the priest's cue, Aliena said, "Alfred, the son of Tom Builder, I take you as my husband, and swear to be faithful always." When she had said that, she wanted to cry. Alfred made his vow next. There was a ripple of noise on the outskirts of the crowd as he spoke, and one or two people looked behind. Aliena caught Martha's eye, and Martha whispered, "It's Ellen." The priest frowned crossly and said, "Alfred and Aliena are now married in the eyes of God, and may the blessing—" He never finished the sentence. A loud voice rang out from behind Aliena. "I curse this wedding!" It was Ellen. A gasp of horror went up from the congregation. The priest tried to continue. "And may the blessing—" Then he stopped, paled, and made the sign of the cross. Aliena turned around. Ellen was standing behind her. The crowd had shrunk back from her. She was holding a live cockerel in one hand and a long knife in the other. There was blood on the knife, and blood spurting from the severed neck of the bird. "I curse this marriage with sorrow," she said, and her words chilled Aliena's heart. "I curse this marriage with barrenness," she said. "I curse it with bitterness and hatred and bereavement and regret. I curse it with impotence." As she said the word impotence, she threw the bloody cockerel up into the air. Several people screamed and cowered back. Aliena stood rooted to the spot. The cock flew through the air, spraying blood, and landed on Alfred. He jumped back, terrified. The grisly object flopped on the ground, still bleeding. When everyone looked up, Ellen was gone. Martha had put clean linen sheets and a new wool blanket on the bed, the great feather bed that had belonged to Ellen and Tom and was now to be Alfred's and Aliena's. Ellen had not been seen since the wedding. The feast had been a subdued affair, like a picnic on a cold day, with everyone grimly going through the motions of eating and drinking because there was nothing else to do. The guests had all left at sundown without any of the usual coarse jokes about the newlyweds' first night. Martha was now in her own little bed in the other room. Richard had returned to Aliena's little house, which would now be his. Alfred was talking of building a stone house for them next summer. He had been boasting about it to Richard during the feast. "It will have a bedchamber and a hall and an undercroft," he had said. "When John Silversmith's wife sees it, she'll want one just like it. Pretty soon all the prosperous men in town will want a stone house. "Have you done a design?" Richard had asked, and Aliena had heard a hint of skepticism, although nobody else seemed to notice. "I've got some old drawings of my father's done in ink on vellum. One of them is the house we were building for Aliena and William Hamley all those years ago. I'll base it on that." Aliena had turned away from them in disgust. How could anyone be so crass as to mention that on her wedding day? Alfred had been full of bluster all afternoon, pouring wine and telling jokes and exchanging sly winks with his workmates. He seemed happy. Now he was sitting on the edge of the bed, taking off his boots. Aliena took the ribbons out of her hair. She did not know what to think about Ellen's curse. It had shocked her, and she had no idea what was going on in Ellen's mind, but somehow she was not frightened by it the way most people were. This could not be said of Alfred. When the slaughtered cock landed on him, he had practically gibbered. Richard had shaken him out of it, literally, holding him by the front of his tunic and jerking him back and forth. He had recovered his wits quickly enough, however, and since then the only sign of his fright had been the relentlessness of his back-slapping, beer-swilling good cheer. Aliena felt oddly calm. She did not relish what she was about to do, but at least she was not being forced to it, and while it might be a little distasteful, it would not be humiliating. There was only one man, and no one else would be watching. She took off her dress. Alfred said, "By Christ, that's a long knife." She undid the strap that held the knife to her left forearm, then got into bed in her undershirt. Alfred finally got his boots off. He pulled off his hose and stood up. He threw a lewd look at her. "Take off your underclothes," he said. "I'm entitled to see my wife's tits." Aliena hesitated. She was reluctant to be naked somehow, but it would be foolish to deny him the first thing he asked. Obediently she sat up and pulled her undershirt off over her head, fiercely suppressing the memory of how differently she had felt when she did the same thing this morning for Jack. "What's a pair of beauties?" Alfred said. He came and stood beside the bed and took hold of her right breast. His huge hands were rough-skinned, with dirt under the fingernails. He squeezed too hard, and she winced. He laughed and released her. Stepping back, he took off his tunic and hung it on a hook. Then he returned to the bed and pulled the sheet off her. Aliena swallowed hard. She felt vulnerable like this, naked, under his gaze. He said, "By God, that's a hairy one." He reached down and felt between her legs. She stiffened and then made herself relax and part her thighs. "Good girl," he said, and thrust a finger inside her. It hurt. She was dry. She could not understand it. This morning with Jack she had been wet and slippery. Alfred grunted and forced his finger in farther. She felt like crying. She had known she would not much enjoy it, but she had not expected him to be so unfeeling. He had not even kissed her yet. "He doesn't love me," she thought. "He doesn't even like me. I'm a fine young horse that he's about to ride. In fact, he would treat a horse better than this. He would pat it and stroke it so that it could get used to him, and he'd talk softly to calm it down." She fought back the tears. "I chose this," she thought. "Nobody made me marry him, so I'll just put up with it now." "Dry as a saw pit," Alfred muttered.
"I'm sorry," she whispered.
He removed his hand, spat on it twice, and rubbed the spittle between her legs. It seemed a dreadfully contemptuous act. She bit her lip and looked away. He spread her thighs. She closed her eyes, then opened them and forced herself to look at him, thinking, "Get used to this. You're going to be doing it for the rest of your life." He got on the bed and knelt between her legs. The shadow of a frown crossed his face. He put one hand between her thighs, opening her up, and the other hand went beneath his undershirt. She could see the hand moving under the linen. His frown deepened.
"Christ Jesus," he muttered.
"You're so lifeless it puts me off. It's like feeling up a corpse." It seemed so unfair of him to blame her.
"I don't know what I'm supposed to do," she said tearfully.
"Some girls enjoy it," he said.
Enjoy it, she thought. Impossible. Then she remembered how, that very morning, she had groaned and cried with delight. But it was as if there was no connection between what she had done then and what she was doing now. That was foolish. She sat upright. Alfred was rubbing himself beneath his shirt. Let me, she said, and she slipped her hand between his legs. It felt limp and lifeless. She was not sure what to do with it. She squeezed it gently, then stroked it with her fingertips. She searched his face for a reaction. He just seemed angry. She carried on, but it made no difference.
Do it harder, he said.
She began to rub it vigorously. It stayed soft, but he moved his hips as if he was enjoying it. Encouraged, she rubbed harder. Suddenly he gave a cry of pain and pulled away. She had rubbed too hard.
Stupid cow, he said,
and he slapped her face backhanded with a swipe that knocked her sideways. She lay on the bed, whimpering in pain and fear.
You're no good. You're cursed, he said furiously.
I did my best.
You're a dead cunt, he spat.
He took her by the arms, lifted her upright, and pushed her off the bed. She fell into the straw on the floor.
That witch Ellen meant this to happen, he said. She's always hated me.
Aliena rolled over and knelt upright on the floor, staring at him. He did not look as if he would hit her again. He was no longer enraged, just bitter.
You can stay there, he said. You're no good to me as a wife, so you can keep out of my bed. You can be a dog and sleep on the floor.
He paused. I can't stand you looking at me, he said with a note of panic in his voice. He looked around for the candle, spotted it, and put it out with a blow, knocking it to the ground. Aliena stayed motionless in the darkness. She heard Alfred moving on the feather bed, lying down and pulling up the blanket and shifting the pillows. She was almost afraid to breathe. He was restless for a long time, tossing and turning in the bed, but he did not get up again, nor did he speak to her. Eventually he was still, and his breathing became even. When she was sure he was asleep, she crawled across the room, trying not to make the straw rustle, and found her way into the corner. She curled up and lay there wide awake. Eventually she began to cry. She tried not to, for fear of waking him, but she could not hold the tears in, so she sobbed quietly. If the noise woke him, he gave no sign of it. She stayed like that, lying on the straw in the corner, crying softly, until eventually she cried herself to sleep. Chapter 12 Aliena was sick all that winter. She slept badly every night, wrapped in her cloak on the floor at the foot of Alfred's bed, and during the day she was possessed by a hopeless lassitude. She often felt nauseated, so she ate very little. But despite that, she seemed to put on weight. She was sure her breasts and hips were larger and her waist thickened. She was supposed to be running Alfred's house, although Martha actually did most of the work. The three of them lived together in a sorry menage. Martha had never liked her brother, and Aliena now loathed him with a passion, so it was not surprising that he spent as much time as possible away from the house, at work during the day and in the alehouse every evening. Martha and Aliena bought food and cooked it unenthusiastically, and made clothes in the evenings. Aliena looked forward to the spring when it would once again be warm enough for her to visit her secret glade on Sunday afternoons. There she could lie in peace and daydream of Jack. Meanwhile, her consolation was Richard. He had a spirited black courser, a new sword, and a squire with a pony, and he was once again fighting for King Stephen, albeit with a reduced entourage. The war dragged on into the new year. Maud had escaped from Oxford Castle and slipped through Stephen's hands once again, and her brother Robert of Gloucester had retaken Wareham, so the old seesaw continued, with each side gaining a little and then losing it. But Aliena was fulfilling her vow, and she could take satisfaction in that, if in nothing else. In the first week of the year, Martha began to bleed for the first time. Aliena made her a hot drink with herbs and honey to ease the cramps, and answered her questions about the woman's curse, and went to find the box of rags that she kept for her own periods. However, the box was not in the house,
and she eventually realized she had not brought it here from her old house when she got married. But that had been 3 months ago, which meant she had not bled for 3 months, not since her wedding day, not since she had made love with Jack. She left Martha sitting by the kitchen fire, sipping her honey drink and toasting her toes, and went across town to her old house. Richard was not there, but she had a key. She found the box without any trouble, but she did not go back right away. Instead, she sat by the cold fireplace, wrapped in her cloak, deep in thought. She had married Alfred at Michaelmas. It was now past Christmas. That was a quarter of a year. There had been 3 new moons. She should have bled 3 times. Yet her box of rags had been on the high shelf, alongside the small grindstone Richard used for sharpening kitchen knives. Now she held it in her lap. She ran a finger over the rough wood. Her finger came up dirty. The box was covered with dust. The worst of it was, she had never made love with Alfred. After that awful first night, he had tried again 3 times, once the following night, then a week later, and again a month after that, when he had come home particularly drunk. But he was always completely incapable. At first Aliena had encouraged him out of a sense of duty, but each failure made him angrier than the last, and she became frightened. It seemed safer to stay out of his way and wear unappealing clothes and make sure he never saw her undressing, and let him forget about it. Now she wondered if she should have tried more. But in truth, she knew it would have made no difference. It was hopeless. She was not sure why. Perhaps it was Ellen's curse, perhaps Alfred was just impotent, or perhaps it was because of the memory of Jack, but she felt certain Alfred never would make love to her now. So he was bound to know that the baby was not his. She stared miserably at the old cold ashes in Richard's fireplace, wondering why she always had such bad luck. Here she was, trying to make the best of a bad marriage, and she had the misfortune to be pregnant by another man after 1 single act of intercourse. There was no point in self-pity. She had to decide what to do. She rested her hand on her stomach. Now she knew why she had been putting on weight, why she kept feeling nauseated, why she was always so tired. There was a little person in there. She smiled to herself. How nice it would be to have a baby. She shook her head. It would not be nice at all. Alfred would be as mad as a bull. There was no knowing what he would do. Kill her, throw her out, kill the baby. She had a sudden terrible foreboding that he would try to do harm to the unborn baby by kicking her in the stomach. She wiped her brow. She had broken out in a cold sweat. I won't tell him, she thought. Could she keep her pregnancy secret? Perhaps. She had already taken to wearing shapeless, baggy clothes. She might not get very big, some women didn't. Alfred was the least observant of men. No doubt the wiser women in the town would guess, but she could probably rely on them to keep it to themselves, or at any rate not to talk to the menfolk about it. Yes, she decided, it might just be possible to keep it from him until after the baby was born. Then what? Well, at least the little mite would have been brought safely into the world. Alfred would not be able to kill it by kicking Aliena, but he would still know that it was not his. He was sure to hate the poor thing. It would be a permanent slur on his manhood. There would be hell to pay. Aliena could not think that far ahead. She had decided on the safest course for the next 6 months. She would try in the meantime to figure out what to do after the baby was born. I wonder whether it's a boy or a girl, she thought. She stood up with her box of clean rags for Martha's first monthly period. I pity you, Martha, she thought wearily. You've got all this in front of you. Philip spent that winter brooding over his troubles. He had been horrified by Ellen's heathen curse, uttered in the porch of a church during a service. There was no doubt in his mind now that she was a witch. He only regretted his foolishness in ever forgiving her for her insult to the rule of St. Benedict all those years ago. He should have known that a woman who could do that would never really repent. However, One happy consequence of the whole horrifying business was that Ellen had once again left Kingsbridge and had not been seen since. Philip hoped fervently that she would never return. Aliena was visibly unhappy as Alfred's wife, although Philip did not believe that the curse was the cause of that. Philip knew almost nothing about married life, but he could guess that a bright, knowledgeable, lively person such as Aliena would be unhappy living with someone as slow-thinking and narrow-minded as Alfred, whether they were man and wife or anything else. Aliena should have married Jack, of course. Philip could see that now, and he felt guilty that he had been so committed to his own plans for Jack that he had failed to realize what the boy really needed. Jack was never meant for the cloistered life, and Philip had done wrong in pressuring him into it. Now Jack's brilliance and energy had been lost to Kingsbridge. It seemed that everything had gone wrong since the disaster of the Fleece Fair. The Priory was more in debt than ever. Philip had dismissed half the building workforce because he no longer had the money to pay them. In consequence, the population of the town had shrunk, which meant that the Sunday market became smaller and Philip's income from rents fell. Kingsbridge was in a downward spiral. The heart of the problem was the townspeople's morale. Although they had rebuilt their houses and restarted their small businesses, they had no confidence in the future. Whatever they planned, whatever they might build, could be wiped out in a day by William Hamley, if he should choose to attack again. This undercurrent of insecurity ran in everyone's thinking and paralyzed all enterprise. Eventually, Philip realized he had to do something to stop the slide. He needed to make a dramatic gesture to tell the world in general, and the townspeople in particular, that Kingsbridge was fighting back. He spent many hours of prayer and meditation trying to decide just what that gesture should be. What he really needed was a miracle. If the bones of St. Adolphus would cure a princess of the plague, or cause a brackish well to give sweet water, people would flood into Kingsbridge on pilgrimage. But the saint had performed no miracles for years. Philip sometimes wondered whether his steady, practical methods of ruling the priory displeased the saint, for miracles seemed to happen more frequently in places where the rule was less sensible and the atmosphere was charged with religious fervor, if not out-and-out hysteria. But Philip had been taught in a more down-to-earth school. Father Peter, the abbot of his first monastery, used to say, "Pray for miracles, but plant cabbages." The symbol of Kingsbridge's life and vigor was the cathedral. If only it could be finished by a miracle. One time he prayed for such a miracle all night, but in the morning the chancel was still unroofed and open to the weather, and its high walls were ragged-ended where they would meet the transept walls. Philip had not yet hired a new master builder. He had been shocked to learn how much they demanded in wages. He had never realized how cheap Tom was. Anyway, Alfred was running the reduced workforce without much difficulty. Alfred had become rather morose since his marriage, like a man who defeats many rivals to become king and then finds that kingship is a wearisome burden. However, he was authoritative and decisive, and the other men respected him. But Tom had left a gap that could not be filled. Philip missed him personally, not just as master builder. Tom had been interested in why churches had to be built one way rather than another, and Philip had enjoyed sharing speculations with him about what made some buildings stand up while others fell down. Tom had not been an exceptionally devout man, but he had occasionally asked Philip questions about theology, which showed that he applied as much intelligence to his religion as he did to his building. Tom's brain had more or less matched Philip's own. Philip had been able to converse with him without talking down. There were too few such people in Philip's life. Jack had been one, despite his youth. Aliena, another, but she had disappeared into her sorry marriage. Cuthbert Whitehead was getting old now, and Milius Bursa was almost always away from the priory, touring the sheep farms, counting acres and ewes and woolsacks. In time, a lively and busy priory in a prosperous cathedral city would draw scholars, the way a conquering army attracted fighting men. Philip looked forward to that time. But it would never come unless he could find a way to re-energize Kingsbridge. "It's been a mild winter," Alfred said one morning soon after Christmas.
We can begin earlier than usual.
That started Philip thinking. The vault would be built that summer. When it was finished, the chancel would be usable, and Kingsbridge would no longer be a cathedral town without a cathedral. The chancel was the most important part of a church. The high altar and the holy relics were kept at the far east end, called the presbytery, and most of the services took place in the choir, where the monks sat. Only on Sundays and holy days was the rest of a church used. Once the chancel had been dedicated, what had been a building site would become a church, albeit an incomplete one. It was a pity they would have to wait almost a year before that happened. Alfred had promised to finish the vault by the end of this year's building season, and the season generally finished in November, depending on the weather. But when Alfred said he would be able to start early, Philip began to wonder whether he might finish early, too. Everyone would be stunned if the church could be opened this summer. It was the kind of gesture he had been searching for, something that would surprise the whole county and give out the message that Kingsbridge could not be put down for long. "Can you finish by Whitsun?" Philip said impulsively. Alfred sucked his breath in through his teeth and looked doubtful. "Vaulting is the most skilled work of all," he said. "It mustn't be hurried, and you can't let apprentices do it." His father would have answered yes or no, Philip thought irritably. He said, "Suppose I give you extra labourers, monks. How much would that help?"
"A little. It's more masons we need, really."
"I might be able to give you one or two more," Philip said rashly. A mild winter meant early shearing, so he could hope to begin selling wool sooner than usual.
"I don't know."
Alfred was still looking pessimistic.
"Suppose I offer the masons a bonus," Philip said, "an extra week's wages if the vault is ready for Whitsunday."
"I've never heard of that before," Alfred said. He looked as if an improper suggestion had been made.
"Well, there's a first time for everything," Philip said testily.
Alfred's caution was getting on his nerves. "What do you say?"
"I can't say yes or no to that," Alfred said stolidly. "I'll put it to the men."
"Today?" Philip said impatiently.
"Today."
Philip had to be satisfied with that. William Hamley and his knights arrived at Bishop Walleran's palace just behind an ox-cart loaded high with sacks of wool. The new season's shearing had begun. Like William, Walleran was buying wool from farmers at last year's prices, and expecting to sell it again for considerably more. Neither of them had had much trouble forcing their tenants to sell to them. A few peasants who defied the rule were evicted, and their farmhouses were burned, and after that there were no more rebels. As William went through the gate, he glanced up the hill. The stunted ramparts of the castle the bishop had never built had stood on that hill for 7 years, a permanent reminder of how Walleran had been outwitted by Prior Philip. As soon as Walleran began to reap the rewards of the wool business, he would probably recommence building. In the days of old King Henry, a bishop had not needed any more defences than the flimsy fence of wooden stakes behind a little ditch that surrounded this palace. Now, after 5 years of civil war, men who were not even earls or bishops were building formidable castles. Things were going well for Walleran, William thought sourly, as he dismounted at the stable. Walleran had remained loyal to Bishop Henry of Winchester through all Henry's switches of allegiance, and as a result had become one of Henry's closest allies. Over the years, Walleran had been enriched by a steady stream of properties and privileges, and had visited Rome twice. William had not been so lucky, hence his sourness. Despite having gone along with each of Walleran's changes of allegiance, and despite having supplied large armies to both sides in the Civil War, he still had not been confirmed as Earl of Shiring. He had been brooding on this during a lull in the fighting, and had become so angry about it that he had made up his mind to have a confrontation with Walleran. He went up the steps to the hall entrance, with Walter and the other knights following. The steward on guard inside the door was armed, another sign of the times. Bishop Walleran sat in a big chair in the middle of the room, as always, with his bony arms and legs at all angles, as if he had been untidily dropped there. Baldwin, now an archdeacon, was standing beside him, his stance suggesting he might be waiting for instructions. Walloran was staring into the fire, deep in thought, but he looked up sharply when William approached. William felt the familiar loathing as he greeted Walloran and sat down. Walloran's soft, thin hands, his lank black hair, his dead-white skin and his pale, malignant eyes made William's skin crawl. He was everything William hated: devious, physically weak, arrogant, and clever. William could tell that Walloran felt much the same about him. Walloran could never quite conceal the distaste he felt when William walked in. He sat upright and folded his arms, his lip curled a little, and he frowned faintly, altogether as if he was suffering from a twinge of indigestion. They talked of the war for a while. It was a stiff, awkward conversation, and William was relieved when it was broken by a messenger with a letter, written on a roll of parchment and sealed with wax. Walloran sent the messenger off to the kitchen to get something to eat. He did not open the letter. William took the opportunity to change the subject. "I didn't come here to exchange news of battles. I came to tell you that I've run out of patience." Walloran raised his eyebrows and said nothing. Silence was his response to unpleasant topics. William ploughed on. "It's almost 3 years since my father died, but King Stephen still hasn't confirmed me as Earl. This is outrageous."
"I couldn't agree more," Walloran said languidly.
He toyed with his letter, examining the seal and playing with the ribbon. "That's good," William said, "because you're going to have to do something about it."
"My dear William, I can't make you Earl."
William had known that Walloran would take this attitude, and he was determined not to accept it. "You have the ear of the king's brother. But what am I to say to him? That William Hamley has served the king well? If it is true, the king knows it, and if not, he knows that also." William was no match for Walloran in logic, so he simply ignored the arguments. "You owe it to me, Walloran, by God." Walloran looked faintly angered. He pointed at William with the letter.
"I owe you nothing. You have always served your own ends, even when you did what I wanted. There are no debts of gratitude between us."
"I tell you, I won't wait any longer."
"What will you do?"
Walloran said with the hint of a sneer. "Well, first I'll see Bishop Henry myself."
"And?"
"I'll tell him that you have been deaf to my pleas, and in consequence I'm changing my allegiance to the Empress Maud." William was gratified to see Walloran's expression change. He went a shade paler and looked just a little bit surprised.
"Change again?" Walloran said skeptically.
"Just one more time than you," William responded stoutly. Walloran's supercilious indifference was shaken, but not much. Walloran's career had benefited greatly from his ability to deliver William and his knights to whichever side Bishop Henry favoured at the moment. It would be a blow to him if William suddenly turned independent, but not a fatal blow. William studied Walloran's face as he mulled over this threat. William could read the other man's mind. He was thinking that he wanted to keep William loyal, but wondering how much he should put into the effort. To gain time, Walloran broke the seal on his letter and unrolled it. As he read, a faint flush of anger appeared on his fish-white cheeks.
"Damn the men!" he hissed.
"What is it?" William asked. Walloran held it out. William took it from him and peered at the letters.
"To the most holy, gracious bishop."
Walloran snatched it back, impatient of William's slow reading.
"It's from Prior Philip," he said. "He informs me that the chancel of the new cathedral will be finished by Whitsunday, and he has the nerve to beg me to officiate at the service."
William was surprised. "How has he managed it? I thought he had sacked half his builders." Walloran shook his head.
"No matter what happens, he seems to bounce back."
He gave William a speculative look.
"He hates you, of course. Thinks you're the devil incarnate."
William wondered what was going on now in Walloran's devious mind.
"So what?" he said. "It would be quite a blow to Philip if you were confirmed as Earl on Whitsunday."
"You wouldn't do it for me. But you'd do it to spite Philip,"
William said grouchily, but in reality he was feeling hopeful. "I can't do it at all," Walleran said, "but I will speak to Bishop Henry."
He looked up at William expectantly. William hesitated. At last, reluctantly, he muttered, "Thank you." Spring was cold and dismal that year, and on the morning of Whitsunday it was raining. Aliena had woken up in the night with a backache, and it was still troubling her with a stabbing pain every now and again. She sat in the cold kitchen, plaiting Martha's hair before going to church, while Alfred ate a large breakfast of white bread, soft cheese, and strong beer. A particularly sharp twinge in her back made her stop and stand upright for a moment, wincing. Martha noticed and said, "What's the matter?"
"Backache,"
Aliena said shortly. She did not want to discuss it, for the cause was surely sleeping on the floor in the draughty back room, and nobody knew about that, not even Martha. Martha stood up and took a hot stone from the fire. Aliena sat down. Martha wrapped the stone in an old, scorched piece of leather and held it against Aliena's back. It gave her immediate relief. Martha started to plait Aliena's hair, which had grown again after being burned away, and was once again an undisciplined mass of dark curls. Aliena felt soothed. She and Martha had become quite close since Ellen left. Poor Martha. She had lost her mother, and then her stepmother. Aliena felt herself to be a poor substitute for her mother. Besides, she was only 10 years older than Martha. She played the role of older sister, really. Oddly enough, the person Martha missed most was her stepbrother, Jack. But then, everyone missed Jack. Aliena wondered where he was. He might be quite close, working on a cathedral in Gloucester or Salisbury. More likely, he had gone to Normandy. But he could be much farther afield, Paris, Rome, Jerusalem, or Egypt. Recalling the stories that pilgrims told about such faraway places, she visualized Jack in a sandy desert, carving stones for a Saracen fortress in the blinding sunlight. Was he thinking of her now? Her thoughts were interrupted by a noise of hooves outside, and a moment later her brother Richard walked in, leading his horse. He and the horse were soaking wet and covered with mud. Aliena took some hot water from the fire for him to wash his hands and face, and Martha led the horse out to the backyard. Aliena put bread and cold beef on the kitchen table and poured him a cup of beer. Alfred said, "What's the news of the war?" Richard dried his face on a rag and sat down to his breakfast. "We were defeated at Wilton," he said. "Was Stephen taken?" "No, he escaped, just as Maud escaped from Oxford. Now Stephen is at Winchester and Maud is at Bristol, and they're both licking their wounds and consolidating their hold on the areas they control." The news always seemed to be the same, Aliena thought. One side, or both, had won some small victory or suffered some small loss, but there was never any prospect of the end of the war. Richard looked at her and said, "You're getting fat." She nodded and said nothing. She was 8 months pregnant, but nobody knew. It was lucky that the weather had been cold, so that she had been able to continue to wear layers of loose winter clothing which concealed her shape. In a few weeks' time the baby would be born and the truth would come out. She still had no idea what she was going to do then. The bell rang to summon the townspeople to mass. Alfred pulled on his boots and looked expectantly at Aliena.
"I don't think I can go," she said. "I feel terrible."
He shrugged indifferently and turned to her brother.
"You should come, Richard. Everyone will be there today. It's the first service in the new church."
Richard was surprised.
"You've got the ceiling up already? I thought that was going to take the rest of the year."
"We rushed it. Prior Philip offered the men an extra week's wages if they could finish by today. It's amazing how much faster they worked. Even so, we only just made it. We took the false work down this morning."
"I must see this," Richard said.
He stuffed the last of the bread and beef into his mouth and stood up. Martha said to Aliena,
"Do you want me to stay with you?"
"No, thanks. I'm fine.
You go. I'll just lie down."
The three of them put on their cloaks and went out. Aliena went into the back room, taking with her the hot stone in its leather wrapping. She lay down on Alfred's bed with the stone under her back. She had become terribly lethargic since her marriage. Previously, she had run a household and been the busiest wool merchant in the county. Now she had trouble keeping house for Alfred, even though she had nothing else to do. She lay there feeling sorry for herself for a while, wishing she could fall asleep. Suddenly, she felt a trickle of warm water on her inner thigh. She was shocked. It was almost as if she was urinating, but she wasn't, and a moment later the trickle turned into a flood. She sat bolt upright. She knew what it meant. Her waters had broken. The baby was coming. She felt scared. She needed help. She called to her neighbor at the top of her voice, "Mildred! Mildred! Come here!" Then she remembered that nobody was at home. They had all gone to church. The flow of water slowed, but Alfred's bed was soaked. He was going to be furious, she thought fearfully, and then she remembered that he was going to be furious anyway, for he would know that the baby was not his child, and she thought, "Oh God, what am I going to do?" The back pain came again, and she realized that this must be what they called labor pains. She forgot about Alfred. She was about to give birth. She was too frightened to go through with it alone. She wanted someone to help her. She decided to go to the church. She swung her legs off the bed. Another spasm took her, and she paused. Her face screwed up in pain until it went away. Then she got off the bed and left the house. Her mind was in a whirl as she staggered along the muddy street. When she was at the priory gate, the pain came again, and she had to lean against the wall and grit her teeth until it passed. Then she went into the priory close. Most of the population of the town was crowded into the high tunnel of the chancel and the lower tunnels of the two side aisles. The altar was at the far end. The new church was peculiar in appearance. The rounded stone ceiling would eventually have a triangular wooden roof over it, but now it looked unprotected, like a bald man without a hat. The congregation stood with their backs to Aliena. As she lurched toward the cathedral, the bishop, Walleran Bygod, got up to speak. She saw, as if in a nightmare, that William Hamley was standing beside him. Bishop Walleran's words penetrated her distress. "With great pride and pleasure that I have to tell you that the Lord King Stephen has confirmed Lord William as the Earl of Shiring." Despite her pain and fear, Aliena was horrified to hear this. For 6 years, ever since the awful day when they had seen their father in the Winchester jailhouse, she had dedicated her life to winning back the family property. She and Richard had survived robbers and rapists, conflagration and civil war. Several times the prize had seemed to be within their grasp, but now they had lost it. The congregation murmured angrily. They had all suffered at William's hands, and they still lived in fear of him. They were not happy to see him honored by the king who was supposed to protect them. Aliena looked around for Richard to see how he was taking this terminal blow, but she could not locate him. Prior Philip stood up with a face like thunder and started the hymn. The congregation began half-heartedly to sing. Aliena leaned against a column as another contraction seized her. She was at the back of the crowd, and nobody noticed her. Somehow, the bad news had calmed her. "I'm only having a baby," she thought. "It happens every day. I just need to find Martha or Richard, and they will take care of everything." When the pain passed, she pushed her way into the congregation looking for Martha. There was a group of women in the low tunnel of the north aisle, and she made for them. People looked curiously at her, but their attention was distracted by something else, a strange noise like rumbling. At first, it was hardly distinguishable from the singing, but the singing quickly died away as the rumbling got louder. Aliena reached the group of women. They were looking around anxiously for the source of the noise. Aliena touched one of them on the shoulder and said, "Have you seen Martha, my sister-in-law?" The woman looked at her, and Aliena recognized the tanner's wife, Hilda. "Martha's on the other side, I think," Hilda said. Then the rumbling became deafening, and she looked away. Aliena followed her gaze. In the middle of the church, everyone was looking up toward the top of the walls. The people in the side aisles craned their necks to peer through the arches of the arcade. Someone screamed. Aliena saw a crack appear in the far wall, running between two neighbouring windows in the clerestory. As she looked, several huge pieces of masonry dropped from above into the crowd in the middle of the church. There was a cacophony of screaming and shouting, and everyone turned to flee. The ground beneath her feet shook. Even as she tried to push her way out of the church, she was aware that the high walls were spreading apart at the top, and the round barrel of the vault was cracking up. Hilda, the tanner's wife, fell in front of her, and Aliena tripped over the prone figure and went down herself. A shower of small stones spattered her as she tried to get up. Then the low roof of the aisle cracked and fell in, something hit her head, and everything went black. Philip had begun the service feeling proud and grateful. It had been a close thing, but the vault was finished in time. In fact, only three of the four bays of the chancel had been vaulted, for the fourth could not be done until the crossing was built, and the ragged-ended chancel walls were joined to the transepts. However, three bays were enough. All the builder's equipment had been ruthlessly cleared out. The tools, the piles of stone and timber, the scaffolding poles and hurdles, the heaps of rubble and the rubbish. The chancel had been swept clean. The monks had whitewashed the stonework and painted straight red lines on the mortar, making the pointing look neater than it really was, in accordance with custom. The altar and the bishop's throne had been moved up from the crypt. However, the bones of the saint in their stone casket were still down there. Moving them was a solemn ceremony called translation, which was to be the climax of today's service. As the service had begun with the bishop on his throne, the monks in new robes lined up behind the altar, and the people of the town massed in the body of the church and crowded into the aisles. Philip had felt fulfilled, and he had thanked God for bringing him successfully to the end of the first crucial stage in the rebuilding of the cathedral. When Walleran had made his announcement about William, Philip had been furious. It was so obviously timed to mar the triumph of the occasion and remind the townspeople that they were still at the mercy of their savage overlord. Philip had been casting about wildly for some adequate response when the rumblings started. It was like a nightmare that Philip sometimes had, in which he was walking on the scaffolding very high up, perfectly confident of his safety, when he noticed a loose knot in the ropes binding the scaffolding poles together. Nothing very serious. But when he bent to tighten the knot, the hurdle beneath him tilted a little, not much at first, but enough to make him stumble, and then, in a flash, he was falling through the vast space of the chancel of the cathedral, falling sickeningly fast, and he knew he was about to die. The rumbling was at first mystifying. For a moment or two he thought it was thunder. Then it grew too loud, and the people stopped singing. Still, Philip thought it was only some strange phenomenon, shortly to be explained, whose worst effect would be to interrupt the service. Then he looked up. In the third bay, where the falsework had come down only this morning, cracks were appearing in the masonry, high on the walls, at the clerestory level. They appeared suddenly and flashed across the wall from one clerestory window to the next like striking snakes. Philip's first reaction was disappointment. He had been happy that the chancel was finished, but now he would have to undertake repairs, and all the people who had been so impressed with the builder's work would say, "More haste, less speed." Then the tops of the walls seemed to lean outward, and he realized with an awful sense of horror that this was not merely going to interrupt the service. This was going to be a catastrophe. Cracks appeared in the curved vault. A big stone became detached from the web of masonry and tumbled slowly through the air. People started screaming and trying to get out of its way. Before Philip could see whether anyone was badly hurt, more stones began to fall. The congregation panicked, pushing and shoving and trampling on one another as they tried to dodge the falling stones. Philip had the wild thought that this was another attack of some kind by William Hamley. Then he saw William, at the front of the congregation, battering people around him in a terrified bid to escape, and realized that William would not have done this to himself. Most people were trying to move away from the altar, to get out of the cathedral through the open west end. But it was the westernmost part of the building, the open end, that was collapsing. The problem was in the third bay. In the second bay, where Philip was, the vault seemed to be holding, and behind him in the first bay where the monks were lined up it looked solid. At that end, the opposite walls were held together by the east façade. He saw little Jonathan, with Johnny Eightpence, both huddled at the far end of the north aisle. They were safer there than anywhere, Philip decided, and then he realized that he should try to get the rest of his flock to safety.
"Come this way!" he shouted. "Everybody, move this way!"
Whether they heard him or not, they took no notice. In the third bay, the tops of the walls crumbled, falling outward, and the entire vault collapsed, large and small stones falling through the air like a lethal hailstorm to land on the hysterical congregation. Philip darted forward and grabbed a citizen.
"Go back!"
he yelled, and shoved the man toward the east end. The startled man saw the monks huddled against the far wall and dashed to join them. Philip did the same to two women. The people with them realized what he was doing and moved east without being pushed. Other people began to get the idea, and a general move east began among those who had been at the front of the congregation. Looking up for an instant, Philip was appalled to see that the second bay was going to go. The same cracks were snaking across the clerestory and frosting the vault directly over his head. He continued to herd people to the safety of the east end, knowing that every person he moved might be a life saved. A rain of crumbled mortar fell on his shaved head, and then the stones started to come down. The people were scattering. Some had taken refuge in the shelter of the side aisles. Some were crowded up against the east wall, among them Bishop Walleran. Others were still trying to crowd out of the west end, crawling over the fallen rubble and bodies in the third bay. A stone hit Philip's shoulder. It was a glancing blow, but it hurt. He put his hands over his head and looked around wildly. He was alone in the middle of the second bay. Everyone else was around the edges of the danger zone. He had done all he could. He ran to the east end. There he turned again and looked up. The clerestory of the second bay was collapsing now, and the vault was falling into the chancel, in exact replication of what had happened in the third bay. But there were fewer victims, because the people had had a chance to get out of the way, and because the roofs of the side aisles appeared to be holding there, whereas in the third bay they had given way. Everyone in the crowd at the east end moved back, pressing up against the wall, and all faces were turned up, watching the vault, to see whether the collapse would spread to the first bay. The crash of falling masonry seemed to become less loud, but a fog of dust and small stones filled the air, and for a few moments no one could see anything. Philip held his breath. The dust cleared, and he could see the vault again. It had collapsed right up to the edge of the first bay, but now it seemed to be holding. The dust settled. Everything went quiet. Philip stared aghast at the ruins of his church. Only the first bay remained intact. The walls of the second bay were standing up to the level of the gallery, but in the third and fourth bays only the side aisles were left, and they were badly damaged. The floor of the church was a pile of rubble littered with the still or feebly moving bodies of the dead and injured. 7 years of work and hundreds of pounds in money had been destroyed, and dozens of people had been killed, maybe hundreds, all in a few terrible moments. Philip's heart ached for the wasted work and the lost people, and for the widows and orphans left behind, and his eyes filled with bitter tears. A harsh voice spoke in his ear.
"This is what comes of your damned arrogance, Philip!"
He turned around to see Bishop Walleran, his black clothes coated with dust, glaring at him triumphantly. Philip felt as if he had been stabbed. To see a tragedy such as this was heartbreaking, but to be blamed for it was unbearable. He wanted to say, "I only tried to do my best," but the words would not come. His throat seemed constricted, and he could not speak. His eye lit on Johnny Eightpence and little Jonathan emerging from the shelter of the aisle, and he suddenly remembered his responsibilities. There would be plenty of time later to agonize over who was to blame. Right now there were scores of people injured and many more trapped in the rubble. He had to organize the rescue operation. He glared at Bishop Walleran and said fiercely, "Get out of my way!" The startled bishop stepped aside, and Philip leaped up on the altar. "Listen to me," he called out at the top of his voice.
We have to take care of the wounded, rescue people who are trapped, and then bury the dead and pray for their souls. I'm going to appoint 3 leaders to organize this.
He looked at the faces all around him, checking to see who was still alive and well. He spotted Alfred.
Alfred Bildur is in charge of moving.